Hey gang, quick question. Are you in a band in Austin looking to make the leap from amateur to full-on pro? Well, you can start by rehearsing where the pros rehearse. That's Space. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. Tons of pros rehearse there, including myself. You can find out more about it by going to spaceatx.com or calling them at 512-448-9518. Talk to someone in their friendly staff, tell them that you heard about us on How Did I Get Here, and get your first hour free. That's right, Space Rehearsal and Recording.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
Right. Hello. I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a great show for you today. I have amazing singer-songwriter Charlie Mars. He was in town a few weeks ago playing some shows. We got together. I sat down. We got on the mics. Caught up. I haven't seen him in like a decade. And it was fun. Fun getting to talk to him, getting to know him, and getting to know what's going on with him. He has a new album coming out on October 14th called The Money. And it's great. I got the chance to listen to it. It was produced by my friend Billy Harvey and mixed by the great Jim Scott. He's got a big show coming up in Austin on August 6th. It's a Blues on the Green show, which is a big show outside with Quiet Company opening. Should be an amazing show. Look out for that if you are in Austin. If not, just find out what's going on with Charlie Mars at charliemars.com. You can also follow him on Twitter, and he's got a Facebook page that he keeps up with very well. Anyway, got a chance to sit down with Charlie and talk to him. We will get to that in just a minute. What's going on with me? I've got a show tonight. My residency continues over at Strange Brew. I'm playing with Kendall Beard and AJ Vallejo, my dear old friend. We're going to play some old songs that we wrote, and should be a lot of fun. So I've been staying at my ex-girlfriend Sandy's house with my dogs. That's been great, except for I haven't gotten a lot of sleep. I went out of town this weekend, played a couple of shows on the road with Skyrocket. They were great shows, but my sleep got all fucked up, and I've been sleeping like 3 and 4 hours a night and then napping like 4 hours in the day, which is just totally weird. I feel like I'm due for a nap right now. Like I can feel one coming on. Like I need one, which I'm going to fight taking. I'm just going to stay up all day and not nap and just play my show tired tonight. That's what I'm going to do. So yeah, if you're in Austin, come out to Strange Brew tonight, July 15th, and check out me, Kendall Beard, and AJ Vallejo. The shenanigans start at 8 tonight. I'll be playing first tonight. Normally I play in the middle. Tonight I'll be playing first. So and in a couple weeks, I'll be playing with Steve Poltz. That should be a lot of fun. So looking forward to that. All right, let's talk to Charlie Mars. His new album, The Money, comes out October 14th. He's got a show August 6th on Blues on the Green. If you are in Austin, he will be at Blues on the Green playing with Quiet Company. Will be great. Here's my conversation with Charlie. He's a great guy. I'm glad we got to do it. Let's get down.
Abigail, I know your day has been hell. Don't take to heart the words that he said. I know you're a good girl. You're not out to hurt nobody. He's just trying to get in your head.
How's it going? You did this album, The Money, in Tornillo.
Yeah.
At the great Sonic Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you like it there?
I can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah.
From the owner, Tony.
Tony's fantastic.
Tony Rancic. How do you say his last name? R-A-N-C-I-C-H.
He's a great guy, man.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Just like a total kind of eccentric cosmopolitan with a generous spirit,
mm-hmm.
who loves studios and musicians and gear.
Yeah.
I literally, everywhere I come across a musician who makes records for a living, I try to mention that place now.
Oh yeah, for
they
sure.
Were so, not only were they, not only was it a wonderful recording experience that's rare in this day and age, they were also really generous.
Yeah.
With spirit, so can't say enough good things about those people.
Yeah. So you did it with Billy again. Is this the second album you've done with Billy or the third? Wow. You've done the last three.
Like a Bird, Like a Plane, Blackberry Light, and The Money.
Yeah. How did you... what was different about this one? You stripped it down and tried to make it... That's what I was reading on your Kickstarter.
Well, I think subject matter, the theme of the record is different. And I view these records as a trilogy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As like the three full band records with the same band, with the same producer, all made in Texas.
Right.
So I perform mostly solo shows now, but I make full band records because my vision for myself has always been where I would have a catalog of full band material that I could go out and perform, and that would be the core of my catalog.
Right.
And that I would also have solo albums and more folk-based acoustic records that I did along with that. But I wanted to have that foundation there. And it is. And I think this is the last of my three, of this sort of core group.
Yeah.
I had an idea in my head always, after the first one of doing it just felt, three is my lucky number. I do a lot of things in threes, and it just always felt like I was going to do this, no matter what. Just
wow.
Make three records with these same five guys.
Band. Yeah.
And two of the records were made at Jack Rocks.
Right.
Which was also a wonderful experience, and he was very generous. And, no records are made without bumps in the road.
No.
But all in all, all of my experiences with everybody, everything in Texas. The difference between Texas and everywhere else is that you've got a bunch of working motherfuckers who ain't afraid to go work.
You mean the music guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not
yeah.
a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Not a lot of red tape. You just, how much you got? Can you do it or not? Let's go make a fucking record.
Yeah.
And that's how it's been with everybody, from the engineers to the studios to the everybody.
Yeah.
And that's why these records have gotten made.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of places where you immediately start getting red tape thrown at you of, you know, that's not our normal rate or blah. Like, everything is always an issue with everybody. But you come to Texas, and at least to date so far,
yeah.
my experience has been one where people recognize where you're coming from and that you're trying to do something original.
Right.
And that though you do make a living and you are successful in that sense, that...
They understand.
Everybody has to understand, and they do. And that's been wonderful because it feels more like a family rather than a business. And that's ultimately what this fucking town is all about anyway.
Totally. That's great. And it's really embraced you. Like, you are a very beloved... It's almost like you're part of the scene here without even living here.
You spend a lot
of time here.
And I think I've thought about that. And why is that? Why do you think that is?
I think that you're really great, and you fell in the right people heard you and mm-hmm. could do something about exposing you, mm-hmm. you know? KGSR has been very supportive of you. Bob Schneider has been very supportive of you, and he's, you know.
I think Austin is a place where if you've never fit in, you come here, and the people who've never fit in allow the people who always fit in to hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the people who never fit in get to have a place where they can all be hang out and feel okay.
Right.
And that's always where I lived. Yeah. If you look at I've been making records since 1996.
Yeah.
At no point in 20 years have I ever had a group of people that I fit in with. There was no Lucinda Williams, Patty Griffin, Steve Earle crowd. There was no John Mayer, Jason Mraz, Citizen Cope crowd.
Yeah.
There was no jam band crowd.
Yeah.
I've never, ever, ever fit in. And the only guy I ever knew like that was Bob.
Yeah.
He was the only person successful that I ever knew that was like that.
Yeah.
And then you come to Austin, and people recognize on an instinctual level, I think, when you are that. When you are something that is...
Genuine,
or it doesn't necessarily mean genuine. You got to be genuine, period.
Yeah.
But that there's also something about you that they relate to as an outsider.
Yeah.
And I think that is what has always felt like why Austin was embraced me in ways that some other towns have now, but weren't the first ones.
Yeah.
And why I love it so much is because of that loyalty. You know, that once somebody takes you in when other people aren't, you're loyal.
Yeah.
Until you know, something fucked up happens.
Yeah, until you make, like, enough bad records to bubble
out.
But you haven't done that. And so, wait, before we go on to some other stuff, the trilogy, and as far as having the same people, it's JJ on drums.
JJ, John Ginty is the only real non-Texas entity, which is the key B3 player from New Jersey who plays with the Dixie Chicks now and plays with the Courtyard Hounds.
And he was playing with you when you played with the Dixie Chicks. I'm friends with Kyle Crusham.
He was in the Chicks band.
Right.
And I don't, I might be, it was either me or Jim Scott, but the way they met him was through my records.
Oh, really?
Of just getting, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I didn't see him in the shows, and he's just so great. But it's George Reef and Monzi. Dave Monzi played on two of the three and would have played in the third, except for, you know, it comes a point where it's like, it's 10 hours away. Why do we need two bass players? Right. Somebody's got to go. But I would say Dave is, like, certainly a mentionable. Is this all going, is this edited at all?
No.
So we just let it stream. Dave was a huge part of all of it. And we missed having him on the third one.
I can see that.
As well as Donnie Wynn
was
a part of the second record. But the core group is the guys that were on Like a Bird, Like a Plane, which are JJ, Billy Harvey, George Reef, me, and John Ginty on keys. And then the engineer, Jim Valentine.
Yeah.
He was
Jim
on
Valentine.
All three records.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jim's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I hear people mention him a lot on this thing. I worked on a record with him a long time ago.
Another example of, like, no red tape, no bullshit, just a great guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and he knows his shit, too.
Yeah.
He really does. And you got Jim Scott to mix this record.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear it. How did it turn out? Is it?
I love it.
Yeah?
I do. I love it. I think it sounds great, and I think it was a great record for him to mix.
Yeah. And Chad Blake mixed your last record?
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds great.
Yeah.
It's an amazing record.
I mean, very few people have ever commented on anything, this stuff, because at the end of the day, you know, people just listen to records and they like them or they don't.
Yeah.
But if you look at the three records that I've done here, on every level, I've tried to create quality, like from the players to the artwork to the photography was all done by Danny Clinch.
Yeah, one of my favorite photographers.
To Chad Blake is currently one of the great mixers out there.
Yeah.
Jim Scott is currently one of the great mixers out there. And I'm an independent artist who does everything himself. I have no management. I have an agent. And I'm involved in every aspect of everything that I do. So to make expensive records at a time when everybody else is making them on computers, it's been a real sacrifice. And I mean, I would like to say that it's been for other people, for my fans or whatever, but it's really just about my own inability to put something out there that I don't feel like has my best foot forward for the best people that I can get, and what I think best serves the songs and best serves the records. And because I feel like every time that I put something out, that my integrity's on the line. And,
well, it is.
And I'm proud of the fact that, you know, I could take the $15,000, $20,000 that it costs for Chad Blake to mix a record and go pay a guy $5,000 to do it, but I don't, because I want it to be the best. And I want everything to be the best it can be. And I go the end of the earth to make that possible.
Yeah.
I mean, Chad Blake, I had to basically, like, it's very difficult to get him to mix the record, let's put it that way. So it took a lot.
Well, luckily, we do live in a time when those guys actually are probably looking for work as well, because there just isn't that much money being thrown around.
We may, but Chad Blake's not one of those people.
No. Right, no, I understand, yeah.
He mixes Black Keys records.
Yeah. Did he do the last one?
Last two, three.
Wow. Wow. So, let's go back. You're from Mississippi.
Yeah.
Born in
Arkansas.
Born in Arkansas?
Lived there a year. Moved to Laurel, Mississippi, where I lived for... till I I lived in Laurel for probably 16 years, and then I went to Jackson, Mississippi my senior year of high school. And then I went to college in Dallas.
Right, at SMU.
Yeah. And that was my first real taste of Texas.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
What was it like growing up in Mississippi? Because that seems to me is where you probably felt like a misfit, too. Because you seem a little more worldly. You have, there's a very interesting thing about you. Like, there's a very honest and down-home southernness to you,
mm-hmm.
but there also is like this kind of like worldly, you know, cosmopolitan vibe going on as well. Am I wrong?
I would like to think that you're right.
Yeah.
I'd like to think you're exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see you like kicking it in Wranglers and really being comfortable in sort of like some weird total southern scene without some kind of artsiness to.
I would say that is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that... So what are you asking?
What I'm asking is, that's when you first started feeling like you didn't fit in? Like you said, in Austin, you feel like people come here that it didn't fit in anywhere else, and they come here and they fit in.
You know, I don't want to paint a picture of something that is where, you know... I wasn't like the goth kid with like,
right.
with like, you know, a clothespin in my nose sitting over in the corner like getting, you know, stones thrown at me by all the rednecks.
Right.
But there was I always had a sense of being different from an early age. And I was always aware of what the price that you have to pay for that is. And I always had a mixed feelings about it. There was always a desire to want to be a part of things, you know, want to be able to be good at sports or run with this crowd of people or be into hunting or, you know, things that would make you more of like someone who got to be accepted and feel whatever in that part of the world. And when you're a kid, before you've developed like psychological defenses against that stuff, it hurts.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, for a lot of my early years of making music, and that creates a certain anger to things, and it drives you, and it did me.
Yeah.
It created an anger in me, and it drove me to want to be good at something and to get out mm-hmm. of that feeling, to be able to not have to feel that, but to be be able to be myself and to be accepted in that. And a way that I saw to do that was to be good at something so that I could I don't know, protect myself from that or something. I don't really know.
So do you sought out music for that?
Yeah, music became an avenue in my teenage years in college where, you know...
It's an identity.
It is an identity. And it allowed me for the first time to feel some of the feelings that I think lots of people desire, like, you know, scoring the touchdown in the end zone and pointing at the crowd and taking the cheerleader home.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I got to... And I liked it. And it was also an avenue to out of just the regionalism that I lived in and a way to start to connect with the world.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I lived in a bubble up until the time that I was 20 years old. I really did. And then from 20 on...
What kind of bubble? Like your family I lived in a rural
part of Mississippi. Uh-huh. Laurel is central Mississippi. So it's not even Jackson, or it's not close to a major city. Like going to Jackson was an hour and a half away. And we got to do that, you know, to go buy school clothes once a year.
Wow.
So it wasn't... I just... And there are the most Christian churches per square mile anywhere in the world
in
Jones County, Mississippi, which is where I grew up.
Yeah.
So in the late 70s and 80s, you're talking about, in some ways, an idyllic childhood because a safe, small, rural, southern town that on the surface you have, you can run around in the woods and play with your friends and all those things. But then on the flip side of that is not a lot of tolerance for people who are different. And not, and certainly a lot of like a fear and shame based culture in the face of all the religious pressures that were going on. And
where did you stand on that religiously? Like, were you?
Well, I was, you know, I my parents believed a certain thing, and I certainly over my whole life felt like a spiritual current along that is, it's like hard to sometimes differentiate between your belief in a spiritual life and then what you're kind of told as a child and as a young adult, and the desire for it to be there and what is real. So what do I believe on that? I have my own personal stuff, and it doesn't necessarily jive
with that.
But in it does in some ways, because when I am when I'm in the shit and I'm having a real hard time and I need to reach outside of myself and ask for the power, the world, God, the spirits that govern this universe to help me. I pray to the same God that I did when I was five.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like in my head. So I don't really know.
That's interesting.
I don't really know the answer.
Yeah.
Except for, you know, there were just things like, you know, I believed up until the time that, until I was maybe 16, that I was going to go to hell I was going to hell. And so when you believe that, based on things that I was just doing in my everyday life, you know, whether it was jerking off when you were a kid or
cussing
or whatever, you know, I really believed that.
Yeah.
And so that created a lot of strain.
Yeah.
You know, psychological strain. And then you couple that with just being sort of a different person altogether, it creates a lot of resentment. And as an adult, I have a lot less of that,
right?
And I don't go around necessarily with a chip on my shoulder so much about it, because I still live in Mississippi, and I've lived there. I lived in New York for 4 years, but most of my adult life I've lived in Mississippi, and I've lived in Oxford for 15 years. And there's things about it. I'm either sixth or seventh generation Mississippian on both sides of my family. My parents are both from the same county.
Wow.
And so, you know, I have a lot of blood invested in that state, and I have a desire to see it flourish. And I don't waste a lot of time running it down, except for, you know, those are some of the things. I would love the idea of a kid getting born in Mississippi and not having to deal with some of the same intolerances. But, you know, no matter where you are, if you're not good at football, you got to go find something else.
Yeah, you do.
Like, it's not like that's any different from anywhere else, except for I just didn't have much of a worldview. There weren't any people around me that were showing me the light.
Right.
And I didn't have a way out.
Yeah.
And so I believe
it felt like a vacuum.
Yeah. It's like I said, I lived in a bubble. And then I got a little older and I met some older guys, and they turned me on to good music. And the music was a gateway, not only physically out, but mentally it was a gateway out.
Yeah.
You know, the books I was reading, the music I was listening to, that was when I developed a hunger for more.
Yeah.
Because that was when I started to believe that, okay, maybe I don't fit in here, but maybe there's somewhere out there that I do.
Yeah.
And that made it a lot better.
Yeah.
It made it a lot easier to realize, like, I'm here for now, but I might be able to find something that's less, maybe harder on my system.
I had the same sort of thing happen in like between 7th and 8th grade, and my whole, like, my posture changed, and I was like comfortable in my skin because I felt like I had an idea of who I was. And before, you know, we're people that are creative and we're trying to fit into this, I mean, it's very rigid. I mean, I lived in Texas growing up too, and it's very that people want you to follow this sort of path, like you play these sports, but some people just aren't fucking good at that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that if you look at my career, my career is a testament to that kid, because there's been times when like I could have gone country.
Yep.
Or I could have played the game and made Goo Goo Dolls sounding music. Or there's lots of different times when I was on a major label that I could have. But if you look at the evidence, it would show that I've always done my thing.
Yeah, I love that record that you made when I first met you.
Every turn, I've done my thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's because, you know, when I was 15 and was doing my thing and it worked for me, I never let go of that. Like, I never let go of that independence, because that was all I had to hold on to. Once you let that go and it doesn't work, then you really have nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've been willing along the way to take a turn away from what might have been an easier path to hold on to the thing that I know will work for me no matter what, which is if I do what I'm proud of and like, then it's a win-win situation no matter what, as long as you can pay the fucking rent.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as you can do that, then you're good. So when did you start out? Did you start out in bands and, like, what kind of stuff were you doing? Rock?
I was in a high school band, and we had some name. We named it after some farmer we knew called Adley Meditifus. And then there was, other guy who was a singer. We were so into R.E.M. That was our band. Because R.E.M. was... R.E.M. is like a metaphor for everything we're talking about.
Of course, yeah, totally.
They were mainstream. Exactly, yeah. They were a mainstream 4 to 5 minute song-based band that also seemed like they were a bunch of guys who were making creative, art-based music that was reflective of a mystique of the Southeast that hadn't really existed. And it sort of used cultural signifiers to paint a broader portrait of the Southeast in a way that made it interesting to us. It made us feel like we were a part of something. It made us want to do something like it. And it opened a door to a world that already existed, like Talking Heads or all these art rock bands that made pop music that I had... just hadn't been exposed to. You know, I was 15 when I heard Document, and that was when, and I heard it was the Violent Femmes and R.E.M. and those. So I was in with some guys, and we made a tape, but I wanted to be the front man. I wanted to be the singer, and in that band I was only playing guitar, and I wasn't a very good singer, but I had my own songs and I was writing the songs for this band.
Okay.
And then some other guy was singing them, and I wanted to do my own thing. So I started, as soon as I got to college at 18, I started my own thing. And I've never done anything else. The only band I was ever in was when I was 15.
That's awesome.
Because, and no one has ever come to me and said, I want to be in a band with you in 20 years of my career. So the only option that I saw was to do what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I think that came, it's that, and that's not to say that I seemed like the kind of person who wanted someone to say that to me. You know, I think
right.
It wasn't like I was going around being a nice guy and inviting that.
Yeah.
I think I've always seemed like maybe someone who had their own thing and had a chip on their shoulder, and that was it, you know. But that's not the truth. The truth is that I always knew that if I was doing my own thing, no one could take it away from me. You know, if you're in R.E.M., once Michael Stipe quits, it's fucking over.
Yeah.
If you're in Charlie Marsh, you know, only I can decide if it's over.
Right.
And I liked that. And there's been times when I would have loved to collaborate. In fact, my record now and my mindset is much more open to collaboration than I've ever been, only because I've lived for so long in the other, you know.
Yeah.
And I have established myself in a way that I feel proud of, and I don't feel like I have anything to prove anymore, because I always felt like if I had a collaboration, it wouldn't be me proving it, it would be the band proving it. And so I don't know, it's childish shit, but
no, it's not, but, it's but, that's real shit,
but I proved it. I've proven it to myself.
Right.
And so, but, you know, for a long time, I just always do my own thing. And even in high school, when I had like a band, my mom would help me design the t-shirts, and we would like rent out the ROTC in Mississippi, and we would charge $5.
Yeah.
And we'd hire a cop, and everybody would come in and get drunk. And then my mom would drive you home, and you'd leave your car at the parking lot. And the cop would drive some people home, and we'd make $900. And, you know, so I've always had the mindset of, like, doing it
yourself
as a success.
Yeah.
Not just doing it. Not, like, working and then making music and then seeing maybe somebody something would come and believe in me.
Yeah.
That's never been... Because most people don't care about it when things started. I've always done it and wanted to be successful at it and get my name and my music out there. That is all. And I think that that drive, in fact, I know that that drive comes from those early years of like not being accepted.
Yeah.
So, you know, that that creates a drive, if you're a certain type of personality, it did in me,
right,
to want to be, you know, to prove those motherfuckers wrong.
Yeah.
Whoever those, if you know, I couldn't even think of someone in my mind that I have some chip on my shoulder against. But it's just the idea of, you know, when you're different and you're successful, it's way better than being different and being unknown.
Yeah.
Because yeah. It's, you know, I don't know. Just, that was what I always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I have done for many years now.
Yeah.
Not at great personal risk and cost and
right.
effort, but...
So wait, so in Dallas, did you played out and started kind of like...
Mm-hmm. I showed up in college there in Dallas, and I didn't know anybody, and I had an academic scholarship to SMU, and I had never been to SMU before except for one time.
Yeah.
And I had gone to public high school in Laurel, and then...
So you were a good student?
Yeah, I was a good student.
Academic scholarship to SMU is not easy to come by.
I don't know if it is or it isn't, but I had one. And then I went to a private high school my senior year of high school, and in that small class there was all these kids going to Harvard and Georgetown and Princeton, and it was the smartest class, at least I was told, that had come through that school. And I felt very, you know, if this falls back in line with the same stuff I was talking about earlier about my ego and my inability to sort of accept my lack of success in some area.
Right.
So I started to go, well, I'm not going to go to a state college like my family did. I want to get out. I want to go do something, you know? And so I started to apply to universities outside of Mississippi. And that was the thing that shifted my thinking from, you know, local and regional to wanting to get out and just do something, just see a big city and be a part of a broader community. And, you know, so I show up in Dallas and I don't know anybody, and I kind of fell in with Jack Ingram. He was at that school at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like playing frat parties and stuff. And I would kind of sit in with him and be like a harmony and play acoustic guitar with him. And that sort of opened the door to a social group of people that he hung out with that really kind of opened the door to everything, because he had made his first record in Rockwall, Texas with this guy named Terrence Slimmons.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that you could make CDs and you could make your own records. And I'd only been in one studio in Mississippi.
Right.
And I just sold a car that I had. I made like $7,500 off of it. And I went and used the money just like Jack had to make a record with the same studio and with the same guy. And that was the beginning. There was the Charlie Mars Band, and I had 10 songs, and I was playing every Wednesday night.
Was that Born and Raised?
No, it was Broken Arrow.
Okay.
And I was playing at the Rhythm Room.
Oh, you remember the Rhythm Room? Yeah, yeah.
Every Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And then slowly, but surely people from school started coming and it became a thing to do. And then that album, by the time I had graduated that from college, that album had already sold 15,000 copies.
Wow.
And so I knew where I was, what I was about to go do.
Yeah.
And we were drawing, you know, between 500 and 1,000 people in college towns all across the Southeast by my senior year and the year after I graduated from college. So,
what did you graduate with a degree in?
English and advertising. Yeah. 2 degrees.
Okay. Dual.
And so, that school was like, you know, looking back and being in Texas and knowing about SMU, it's a typecast place where it's like rich kids and all of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't like grow up poor or anything, but I didn't grow up like that. But when I got there, it was a similar scenario to what happened in Laurel. You know, it was like, here's all these people with all these opportunities and money and success, and you know, they're from big cities from all over the country, and here I'm this guy. You know, and it gave me again like this feeling of I have something to prove.
Yeah.
And on the negative, as well as the positive, it put a chip further, just made it where I was determined to sort of rise.
Yeah.
To rise up. But it created, you know, I would say, I don't know. I don't think that I didn't grow in my mind as an artist until after that experience. I think that was more of a time when, you know, people were starting bands and playing the colleges and selling their CDs and grassroots in it. But I wouldn't say that it was as thoughtful of a time for me. Like, I wasn't as serious about the kind of person that I was going to become, or what I saw as negatives about my situation. Really, by that point, I just wanted to be accepted by somebody.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be good at something.
Yeah.
And that was when I landed in Dallas.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
What did you do after you graduated? Did you move back to Mississippi?
No, we found a manager. You know, there was a manager interested, and they signed us in Atlanta. And so we decided to be close to management. I was playing with 3 guys that I went to college with. And we were a band in the sense that the Dave Matthews Band was a band. We were the Charlie Mars Band.
We were still a songwriter, visionary.
But I wouldn't have made it where I did if it wasn't for the sacrifices of those guys.
Sure.
And in the end, you know, the people that I got to go on and have a career, and they, when they left, they didn't get a lot of reward for the fact that I got to go on and have a career. And so, you know, they did make sacrifices that they were not compensated for in the same way that guys get compensated to play with me now. And so I was lucky to have those guys that were willing to be, and their names were Andrew Hanmer, he was the drummer from Dallas, Andy Sample was a bass player from Dallas, and a guy from Mississippi named Matt Ulmer. And those guys made a lot of sacrifices on our behalf, and had that worked, had it been that entity, been something that was going to go on and be a big thing, it would have all worked together. But as it were, you know, they went on and did things with their lives, and I was left solo with no band and just had to figure out what to do.
And whenever you did that and you got without a band, you just went ahead and kicked it and played solo shows because that's what you were doing?
No, then, you know. So I made that first record, and then I made 2 records after that.
Right.
They were all made in Atlanta and Athens, Georgia area. And I made a record with this guy named Brian Holmes, who was a drummer from a band called The Producers.
Oh, dude.
And,
huge fan.
Peter Stroud played on that record. Oh. I saw him the other night with Sheryl Crow at the 40th anniversary thing for ACL. And
wasn't Tim Smith part of that whole crew of people too?
Yeah, but he wasn't on that record. Oh. And then, but I guess, you know, I got into drugs and alcohol and spent a few years, you know, touring and partying a lot and burned out and had to regroup and figure out what I was going to do. And I got sober and stopped drinking alcohol and was left kind of back in Mississippi after 3 or 4 years of touring around with those guys and making 3 records with no management, no label, no agent, no songs, and no money. So that was where I started from. And then I borrowed about $10,000 and I won some money gambling, and I borrowed some money from my parents and went to Atlanta and made the record, which V2 then a month later bought from me. And that was the beginning of my second half of my career, yeah, which was the V2 era, the just Charlie Mars, no Charlie Mars band.
Yeah.
And that was an experience unto itself. You know, that was a time when money, labels still had money, and
yeah,
I got to do the whole ride. You know?
I was thinking that today when I went back and I was listening to it and, to that record, because that's when I met you, mm-hmm, and I was thinking like, wow, he's one of the last guys that I know that got that kind of like, you know,
push. Yeah,
yeah.
And the thing that did is, the album didn't do that well. I mean, by label standards.
Sure.
But what it did do is it gave me an open door at something like radio, for example. I've released 3 records. I will have released, this is my 3rd record, to 4, including the V2 record, to the AAA format. And radio stations have programmers, and programmers are human beings. And in order to get your songs played on those radio stations, it doesn't hurt to have a relationship with those human beings.
And the thing is it's not disingenuous, because a lot of those people are fucking nice people.
Totally. I have, yeah, radio people that I have relationships with because we have a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that means they play my songs or not, that's, my relationship is not based on that. But to even have the relationship at all, you have to have a lot of money spent on you to show up at the places that cost a lot of money to be.
Yeah.
And to get to go into a radio station, unless you're on a label and people have heard of you, or at least they're needing to hear of you, there's no reason for them to have you in the station.
Yeah.
So even though that experience may not have, you know, made me a household name or whatever, it did open the door to making my career now possible, because,
yeah,
I do have songs on the radio.
Yeah.
I do have songs on satellite radio. I do have songs in movies and television shows, and have on my last 3 indie releases.
Yeah.
And if it weren't for the money that V2 Records spent getting my, whatever you want to call it,
name
out there,
yeah,
I don't know if I would have been able to then parlay that into 2009 and beyond.
Wow. It's true, and you took advantage of it, not in a bad way, but you were luckily sober, probably helped to be aware of what was going on. So, during that time you toured, I met you, you were touring with Bob Schneider,
uh-huh,
and I was in another band doing the earliest slot, I guess, on that tour, and I know that you went on to do more shows with him, but then also, didn't you tour with R.E.M.?
Yeah.
On that record,
yeah,
too? Like, uh-huh, what all...
That was their last North American tour.
Wow.
It was on an album called Around the Sun, and I was the opening act for the North American run.
Was there...
Me and Joseph Arthur. He was on another leg of the tour.
Yeah. He's great.
Really like,
yeah, it. You I mean, what was that? It must have been amazing feeling to know that you started out inspired by this band that you were now opening for years later.
It changed me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Did you get to spend time with them, or
oh,
was,
yeah,
there a distance?
I have a relationship with them.
That's good.
I really was probably, Mike Mills is the one that I kept in touch with, but Peter Buck was amazing. Michael,
yeah,
Stipe was amazing. They were just such generous, gracious people the,
yeah,
whole time. They didn't have to be, and they were. But, you know, another thing is, like, when you're a singer-songwriter and you have to deal with a lot of comparisons.
Yeah.
You deal with a lot of insecurities.
Yeah.
Especially starting out, especially when you don't have, like, maybe the natural ability of somebody like, you know, Bill Withers or Aretha Franklin or somebody. You have to really almost carve it out of yourself and really find out what is your thing, and then grow over time into something that's harder, less of like of a natural talent, but you grow into something based on a combination of talent and experience. And I guess my point is that I had a certain insecurity because the people that I idolized growing up were like Jackson Browne and Neil Young, and I felt myself falling more into this, but I don't know if it was a fault of my own or into more of like a Dave Matthews, Jason Mraz kind of world that just didn't feel as, I don't know, like
maybe really just
rooted in integrity as a songwriter and someone that should be taken seriously. More just like, I don't know what I'm looking for, but like the difference between somebody like Springsteen and then somebody that's more just for fun.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I got to open for R.E.M., that was, to me, was like, in my way I felt in my heart was, no one can take this away from me. Like, I am opening up for a band that I would have given anything to fucking meet that band. To play with them and open their North American tour, it was like this stamp of approval, because they picked me to do it. That made me feel, made me believe in a part of myself that had just felt insecure before. Yeah. So when I say it changed me, it did. And from that point on, I have never doubted in myself. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. Right. But I've not doubted. I haven't doubted that what my dreams were can come true, and that what I'm doing is good enough, and that I have the ability to do something great. No. After that, and there's been lots of things since then: Steve Earle tours, and Dixie Chicks tours, yeah, and Citizen Cope tours, and you know. And I've never felt like I didn't belong in those. On those, I do feel like it. I feel like, and I think that when you put me on the stage now, I prove it. Every night.
That's what Kyle was saying, that he was moved by your ability to get up in front of those Dixie Chicks crowds, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's 20,000, 30,000 people in those audiences. Yeah. And whether you're like the greatest entertainer in the world or you're already known or whatever, I know that if you put me on stage in front of 10,000 people who are quiet, and then you take anyone else and put them on stage in front of 10,000 people who are listening, no matter who they are, if the crowd has not heard of them and the crowd has not heard of me, they're going to have a tough time keeping up.
It's good.
Well, I know it.
I mean, how are you going to be able to get up on stage without knowing that? You know what I mean? How can you get in that position? How can you go stand in front of 30,000 people virtually by yourself, right?
No, totally by myself.
Yeah.
And unknown, and bringing the house down.
Yeah.
And I have it on video. We can watch it. So it's not like I'm not tooting my own horn. I guess what I'm saying is,
no, definitely. I found out a guy that was there.
I found out what I'm great at.
Yeah.
And what I'm great at is entertaining people as well as being a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a rare thing. And it made me feel like I had a place at the table with anybody. And if you are really great at something, and you might look at me and say, well, he's not as good at me at that.
Right.
I can look at you and say, then let's go stand on stage in front of 10,000 people who've never heard of you and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I believe that now. And when you believe in yourself, everything gets a lot more fun.
Yeah.
You don't have the same insecurities. You don't worry at the end of the day. Like, and I became a lot happier about what it is that I do. And I don't really give too much of a shit about popular tastes, or as long as I feel like I have, or you know, what critics say or anything, because the critics aren't the ones that have to get on stage. Not that I've been particularly like lambasted in any way.
No,
but
no.
But just I have felt a little looked over.
I think that's a genuine feeling from anyone that's in pop culture that,
sure,
you know, makes their living off of it. So, I think even like Paul McCartney in some way feels looked over for something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, you know, that's probably just my own stuff. But
yeah.
But that's what, you know, you're not going to have the drive to do what I do unless you
feel like you have something.
Yeah, yeah. Feel like you have something to prove.
Yeah.
So I don't know what your question was, but hopefully I answered it.
I think you did. So what, the album comes out on October 14th,
mm-hmm,
which is really cool because that's my birthday.
All right.
I didn't, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was going to be on a Tuesday this year. Are you going to tour? You're going to go out and you're just going to stay out? You're just kind of always on tour. Right?
Yeah. I mean, since 2008, I have pretty much been on tour nonstop. Because if you want to, in order to release records nationally, which I do, and pay for them, you have to work, constantly work. Yeah. I have to constantly work. I can never stop, because as soon as I do, the bills pile up and I feel like I'm not, you know, the music business the way it is these days. Just because your last record sold whatever copies, yeah, and just because 1,000 people came to your show 2 years ago,
yeah,
that doesn't mean that 10 are going to come to the next one.
Right.
And that's, it's not, it stinks that that's how it is, but that it, at the end of the day, that is how it is. So, yeah. I mean, when you look at work ethic and what you have to do to stay present, that's, I've never had like some windfall thing like, oh, we got your song on an iTunes commercial, so you don't have to do shit for a year. Like,
right,
nothing like, but I've always had good things happen as a result of the hard work.
Right. You seem like the kind of person that if you did get that, you would work really hard for that year that you could have taken off. You know what I mean?
I think at this point I might take a break. But, but you know, I don't, I think that when you do what I do, everything's very personal. And when you live in kind of your own world of as an artist, especially when you're not necessarily part of a community of people, and you're like more like a pirate, and you have other friends who are pirates, and you occasionally meet up, and you have some time together, and then you get back on your ships and you go your own directions.
Yeah.
That's where I live. And so, I think, you know, you develop like a survival set of where you just, you do what you have to do.
Yeah.
And for me, it's always, I've always had to work. And if I wanted to continue to do this, you know, when I take 3 months off, it's amazing how far you can fall in six months, a year, you know, so there's been no break. And if I had like a more established, like, hell yeah, I'm in the tour bus now and we're doing 3,000 people a night and we got a fucking record label and everybody's paying for everything, I would, sure, I'd take 3 months off in the fall with my girlfriend and go to the beach.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen, you know. It's just the bills come in and you got to pay them. If you want to stay in the game, you got to keep going.
Yeah. It's interesting. It never stops.
It hasn't.
No.
I think if I had more security, I would take breaks. I would have a healthier balance.
Yeah.
But I never have. And I think maybe as somebody who's a listener, the good thing you're getting out of that is somebody who's never had it easy. And when you never have it easy, it's coming from a real place because you're hungry and you're starving and you're trying to get out of that.
Yeah.
It's the same shit I was talking about when I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
Except for a lot of things that happened that made me feel great about it. And I feel like I've achieved things that I wanted to achieve. But I've still always been a lean artist. Somebody who had to work and really hard to survive.
Yeah.
So, you know, and at the end of the day, it's not been so bad. Because I like the fact that my songs are still coming out from a place that, like, I drive 14 hours in a van to go get a paycheck. And, like, yeah, I know... like, who works behind the counter at the gas stations between here and Oxford, Mississippi.
Yeah.
And I pump my own gas, and I pay for the stuff, and I save the receipts, and I'm involved in on every level. And so are lots of musicians. There's many, many, many musicians out there who are on my level, and we all complain that we're not bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully, those of us who may have made a living at it sit back at the end of the day and feel proud that in a job that very few people actually make a living at, that I've made it 17, 18 years.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that. And
you
feel, I have respect for myself because of it. And that feels good.
Yeah. I like also, I mean, I don't think, I think your records get better and better and they get more breadth, you know, with the D.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I wouldn't keep making them if I didn't feel like I was bringing the goods.
Yeah.
And I still have something to prove. You know, and until... my goal has always been to have a set group of musicians that I'm loyal to, that I play with, and we travel around and we play to enough people to afford a salary for the band, a tour bus, and to be able to take a little time off every year. And to play for an appreciative audience in clubs and theaters that enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that dream hasn't become a reality yet. And so that's, I just go, I'm just going to go until I'm dead, until it is.
Yeah. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that, the thing is, it's not the realization of the reality. I've seen that. I know what, I've lived in fame.
Yeah.
I've seen everything from the inside out. Not, I've had my own brushes with it, and I've been close to it.
Right.
And what I've realized and know deep in my heart is that the realization of the dream does not bring some freedom from life's ills.
No.
Pain,
the
resentments that you have, the people you want to show, or whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't even hardly do anything.
Yeah.
But having the dream to chase,
yeah,
is why you get out of the bed.
Yeah.
And if I let go of that dream, you know, then what do I, what's, what, you know, there's, that's not going to work for me.
Yeah.
You know. And people find fulfillment in their dream of raising a child, their dream of owning a home, their dream of getting to take some family vacation that they ever wanted,
right,
always wanted to have. Everybody's dream is different.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying, like, you got to have some unrealistic dream to be your dream.
No,
but,
you need
but
something.
But my dream has always been this.
Yeah.
And when I get that dream, when that dream becomes true, because I believe that it will or I wouldn't do it.
Right.
Then I'll feel happier. Because I feel happier because of the things that I set out to do that I wanted to accomplish and did. They have made me happier. They made me feel like proud,
yeah,
of getting to a point that most people never reach.
Yeah.
And to say, so to say, I guess they can improve your life if you're thinking about it for the right reasons. The money and the success and all those things just create more problems. But when it comes to having a dream and a goal and realizing it for the right reasons, they do change you when you realize them. They show you that you can win at something.
Yeah.
In this life.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm not sounding like a dick on this thing.
No, not at all. No, no. This is, I'm inspiring. It's good, you know. This is a difficult business to navigate, and it has changed so much, just so much since both of us have gotten into it. Since you put out that Charlie Mars V2 record to now, this is a fucking different world.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't buy single records. There's streaming shit. There's people are living on their phones with music and stuff. Back then, I don't think there was even music on your phone or anything. Maybe you could get a ringtone or something, but you didn't have, like, your catalog of everything you listen. You know what I mean? All that stuff is very...
At the same time, people are still turning the knob on their radio and listening to a new song.
Sure.
And going online and
downloading
the full album and buying it.
They're
doing it. Millions of people are doing it all the time.
Yeah.
So, and in many ways, the job has gotten easier because if you make a product, back in the day, you had to figure out how to get it from a distributor to a store.
Right.
And say a guy in Reykjavik, Iceland, wants to buy your song.
How's he going to get it?
How's he going to get it? But now, they can go online, and the distribution chain is so streamlined, and the second that they buy it, the money goes to your TuneCore account,
right,
and you can withdraw it.
Yeah.
And on that level, it's gotten much easier. The difficulties become in the fact that there's no filters anymore, so everybody's out there, and how do you become the guy that people know about versus these 4,000 other people that have YouTube videos?
Your relationships at radio and things like that will help you.
Relationships on every level.
Yeah.
Every tour that I've ever gotten on has been because... That's not true. Every tour that I've done opening for somebody since 2008, and most of the touring that I got on before I was on V2, because they're relationships of people that had good ones that made things happen for me at that time, have been because of personal relationships with the artists. And that's because I'm on the road 150 days a year, and I run into these people. I see these people. I meet these people, and we become friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, people are always asking me, how'd you get this? How'd you get that? It's like, go work, man. You'd be surprised what happens when you get in the band.
Yeah.
Be surprised what happens. And you know what? It may be 100 bad nights. But the 101st bad night, you wind up sitting next to some guy who's going to do 30 shows in the UK, and you open for him to 2,500 people a night, and then all of a sudden it's all worth it.
Yeah.
So it's not it's not a business for the faint of heart.
No.
And it's not a business for people who are looking to, you know, not put it first.
Yeah.
Because unless it's first, you're just living a hobby.
Yeah.
You're not living a dream.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good place to leave it. People can find all of your music at charliemars.com. And it's all on iTunes, too. Yeah?
Everything's on iTunes.
Everything's there.
Yeah.
I was looking at that today.
Yeah.
And you're an active tweeter.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and you do that yourself. And people can look on your Facebook. All your dates are there, and you're
yes.
always posting.
Yes.
And is there anything coming up in the next few weeks?
Well, I have Blues on the Green.
Oh, yeah.
August the 6th here in
With,
Austin.
With Quiet Company, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I'm excited about.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking about doing a residency in Austin prior to the release of the record. I don't know exactly when that's going to happen, either August or September.
Oh, cool.
And then I'll be on tour, probably doing the CD release shows here the third week of October. And then I'll be on tour all of November. And then back on a more extensive tour like January, February, March of 2015.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, man, I wish you a lot of luck. I'm really looking forward to listening to this record. And also, I'm a fan, man. I love what you do. And I'm very watching you and your success and watching you grow as an artist over the last decade, I guess, has been really great.
Thank you.
So, thanks, Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
We can listen to the dark side of the moon. If you want to come over and get high. We can listen to the dark side.
Yeah. Charlie Mars, man, great conversation. I'm glad we got to do it. It's been a long time coming. And you can follow him and find out what's going on with him. Go to his website, charliemars.com, or you can follow him on Instagram and Twitter, and you can like his Facebook page, okay? He has an album called The Money, which comes out on October 14th, 2014, produced by our dear friend Billy Harvey. It's a great album. I've gotten a chance to listen to it. You're about to hear a song from it. So I'd like to thank Charlie again for letting me stop by and talk to him, because I went to him. We had a great conversation. If you're in Austin, August 6th, he will be at Blues on the Green with Quiet Company, who we love here at the show. All right, so go to charliemars.com, find out what's going on with Charlie, do what you got to do. While you're out there on the internet, don't forget to go to Facebook, like How Did I Get Here's Facebook page. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. A lot of stuff going on. Don't forget, tonight I'm doing the show at Strange Brew with AJ Vallejo and Kendall Beard tonight. That's right, the residency continues. Shows galore. All right, let's hear a little bit more from Charlie Mars. This is from his new album, The Money, which comes out October 14th, 2014. All right. Thank you, Charlie Mars, for talking to me, and let's get down.
Smoking that smoke from an apple by the exit sign. Can I get a hell yeah? Hell yeah. Oh, I wish I was on that river wide, and I was rolling gently home, and that I had one last chance to do it all over again. I thought me a house, yeah, with a little white picket fence. Looking out another window at 20 East Texas night, south of the rock where I was born. I remember those frosty nights. Can I get a hell yeah? Hell yeah. I wish I was on that river wide, and I was rolling gently home, and that I had one last chance to do it all over again. I bought me a house, yeah, with a little white picket fence. I bought me a house, yeah, with a little white, a little white, a little.
promise. Make me a promise you can't keep. Oh, if you get in trouble, I can get you out. About that girl, I got no doubt. Just to look at all the trouble I've been in. Can I get a hell yeah? Hell yeah. I was on that river wide and I was rolling gently home. And that I had one last chance to do it all over again. I'd buy me a house, yeah, with a little white picket fence. I'd buy me a house, yeah, with a little white picket fence. I'd buy me a house, yeah. Another window and another picket fence goes by.